from Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
Ed, I can say that if somebody from Al-Qaeda is calling you, we'd like to know why. In the meantime, this program is conscious of people's civil liberties, as am I. This is a limited...
The Justice Department has launched an investigation into who leaked information on the National Security Agency's secret domestic spy program. Senators are calling for an investigation into what they call Bush's illegal order. We'll speak with an NSA whistleblower who wants to testify before Congress over the agency's role in what he describes as an emerging police state. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The Justice Department has opened a criminal investigation into the disclosure of the Bush administration's secret program to spy on Americans and foreign nationals without court approval warrants. Prosecutors say the investigation will focus on who may have leaked classified information to the New York Times, which broke the story last month. Meanwhile, the New York Times is reporting a top Justice Department official held up approval of the secret spy program over concerns about its legality and oversight in March of 2004. Acting Attorney General James Comey refused to sign on to the program's continued use. Comey was serving in place of then-Attorney General John Ashcroft while Ashcroft was hospitalized. Comey's refusal prompted senior presidential aides Andrew Card and Alberto Gonzalez to visit Ashcroft in his hospital room to grant the approval. The Times reports Ashcroft expressed reluctance to sign off on the program. It's unclear if he eventually relented. Both Ashcroft and Comey's concerns appear to have led to a temporary suspension of parts of the program for several months, according to the Times. In Pakistan, heavy snow and rain have brought new complications to the country's already hampered earthquake relief effort. Since Saturday, icy rain and more than a foot of snow have hit some of the country's most earthquake-ravaged areas, flooding makeshift tent camps and cutting off delivery of desperately needed aid. This is Oxfam's Farhana Farooqi Stoker.
We feel that the situation is desperate. If the situation was not desperate, you would not find people who have suffered because of the earthquake, who have lost family members, who have lost their homes, who have lost their lifelong belongings, now pushed to making decisions to come down and leave their village and their homes. So it is an ultimate, you know, state of desperation.
Oxfam's Farhana Farooqi Stoker. In Iraq, Reuters is reporting a U.S. airstrike has killed 14 members of one Iraqi family in the northern town of Baiji. An Iraqi military spokesperson said the air raid damaged an additional four houses, injuring at least three other people. Elsewhere in Iraq, armed forces have killed four Iraqis demonstrating against the country's drastic increase in oil prices. It's unclear if the demonstrators were killed by U.S. or Iraqi forces. The shootings occurred in the northern village of Rahinawa near Kirkuk. This is an unidentified relative of one of the dead.
They killed my brother. I was standing in the streets about 10 meters away from him, and they wouldn't let me go near his body. They dragged him out of his car with other residents, and they were treating them like they weren't human beings.
A relative of one of the four killed Iraqi protesters. Outrage has erupted across the country as Iraq has seen a fivefold increase in oil prices in recent weeks. The increase is attributed to the elimination of Iraq's oil subsidies as required by a debt relief deal Iraq's interim government signed with the International Monetary Fund. In related news, Iraq's Deputy Prime Minister Ahmed Chalabi has been named interim oil minister. Chalabi was appointed to replace Ibrahim Bar al-Loom, who was forced out after publicly criticizing the IMF deal. This is the second time Chalabi has held the oil minister position. Meanwhile, government officials say Iraq's oil exports have reached their lowest levels since the U.S.-led invasion of March 2003, with shipments now at about half the level seen under Saddam Hussein. In other Iraq news, the New York Times has revealed controversial Pentagon contractor the Lincoln Group has been paying Sunni religious scholars for assistance with its propaganda efforts. The company is already under investigation over the disclosure it secretly paid Iraqi newspapers to publish American-authored articles favorable to the U.S. military. That investigation is reportedly complete. Military officials told the Times an initial assessment concluded the military was, quote, operating within our authorities and the appropriate legal procedures. Meanwhile, a new poll by the magazine group Military Times shows support for President Bush among U.S. armed forces has fallen over 10% in the last year. The survey found support for Bush's overall policies at 60%, down from 71%. Support for the Iraq War is at 54%, down from 63%. The Times says the poll found, quote, diminished optimism that U.S. goals in Iraq can be accomplished, and a somewhat smaller drop in support for the decision to go to war in 2003. In Syria, the government says it'll put former Vice President Abdelhalem Khaddam on trial for corruption just days after Khaddam linked Syrian President Bashar al-Assad to the murder of Lebanese ex-premier Rafiq Hariri. In an interview with Al Arabiya television on Friday, Khaddam said al-Assad had threatened Hariri just months before his death. Hariri and 22 other people were killed in a Beirut car bombing last February. Khaddam, who was a key planner of Syria's dominant role in neighboring Lebanon, said al-Assad told Hariri, quote, I will destroy anyone who tries to hinder our decisions. This news from Egypt. The Egyptian government has announced plans to deport over 600 Sudanese migrants just days after police killed close to 30 unarmed Sudanese on Friday. The killings occurred outside United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees office in Cairo, where the Sudanese had gathered to protest the UN's decision to deny them refugee status. After failing to disperse them with water cannons, police stormed the crowd with clubs and metal sticks. Close to 30 people, most of them children, elderly, and women, were killed. Another 2,000 people were arrested. Sudanese refugees have waged a bitter three-month protest alleging racism and mistreatment in Egypt. While many have been granted permission to stay in Egypt, the Sudanese are demanding the UN grant them refugee status so they may emigrate to other countries. In Turkey, the government's denying newspaper reports the United States has asked to use local military bases for possible attacks on neighboring Iran. Several newspapers have reported high-level U.S. officials have visited Turkey in recent months to prepare for Turkish-based strikes against Iran's nuclear facilities. The officials have included the heads of both the CIA and FBI. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice is also expected to visit the country in the coming weeks. In a statement, the Turkish Foreign Ministry said the reports have, quote, no connection with reality. In the Gaza Strip, three British citizens have been released following their kidnapping last week. Aid worker Kate Burton and her parents were kidnapped by a previously unknown militant group on a visit to a Gaza refugee camp. The group initially demanded Israel cease the bombardment of a northern Gaza area declared off limits to Palestinians last week. The kidnapping prompted widespread calls throughout the Palestinian territories for the hostages' release. In the Philippines, a judge said today he'll soon be issuing an arrest warrant for four U.S. Marines accused in the rape of a Filipino woman. The four Marines were charged last month for the rape of a 22-year-old woman near a former U.S. Navy base in November. The U.S. Embassy has not responded to a request to hand them over to local authorities. And in Haiti, national elections have been postponed yet again for a fourth time. After original plans for a vote last October, the election had most recently been set for January 8th. The delay all but confirms Haiti will be unable to have a new government in place by February 7th, the date specified by the Constitution. Haiti is holding its first election since the February 2004 overthrow of the government of President Jean-Bertrand Aristide. And in other news, the Associated Press has announced its ended ties with a reporter found to have been working for the U.S. government-backed National Endowment for Democracy. The NED, which receives annual funding from the U.S. Congress and State Department, has been linked to supporting opposition groups favorable to U.S. government positions in countries such as Venezuela and Haiti. The reporter, Regine Alexander, had contributed at least one dozen articles for the AP and at least two for the New York Times. Her ties to the NED were exposed by independent journalist Anthony Fenton and radio host Dennis Bernstein on the radio program Flashpoints on Pacifica's KPFA. And in West Virginia, rescue crews continue their attempt to reach 13 coal miners trapped at least 260 feet below ground following a mine explosion on Monday. The explosion at Upshur County's Sagon mine appeared to have been caused by lightning. There's no word on whether any of the 13 survived. Rescue teams were forced to enter the mine more than 11 hours after the blast due to dangerously high levels of carbon monoxide. The mine has reportedly been cited for several health and safety violations, with over 200 citations during 2005, up from 68 the year before. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We turn now to the growing controversy over President Bush's decision to order the National Security Agency to eavesdrop on U.S. citizens inside the country without the legally required court warrants. Bush's decision was first revealed in the New York Times mid-December. The Times published the expose after holding the story for more than a year under pressure from the White House. The paper reportedly first uncovered the illegal order prior to the 2004 election. When the editors at the Times decided last month to go ahead with the article, President Bush personally summoned the paper's publisher, Arthur Sulzberger, and executive editor Bill Keller to the Oval Office in an attempt to talk them out of running the story. Since the story broke, calls for congressional hearings and the possible impeachment of the president have intensified. Conservative legal experts have even admitted Bush may have committed an impeachable offense by ordering the NSA to break the law. On Sunday, the New York Times revealed there was dissent even within the upper echelon of the Bush administration over the legality of the president's order. According to the New York Times, Attorney General John Ashcroft's top deputy, James Comey, refused to sign on to the continuation of the secret program in 2004 amid concerns about its legality and oversight. At the time, Comey was serving in place of then-Attorney General John Ashcroft while Ashcroft was hospitalized for a medical condition. Comey's refusal prompted senior presidential aides Andrew Card and Alberto Gonzalez to visit Ashcroft in his hospital room to grant the approval. The Times reports Ashcroft expressed reluctance to sign on the program. It's unclear if he eventually relented. Both Ashcroft and Comey's concerns appear to have led to a temporary suspension of parts of the program for several months. But the administration has repeatedly defended its actions. This is President Bush speaking on Sunday.
Ed, I can say that if somebody from Al-Qaeda is calling you, we'd like to know why. In the meantime, this program is conscious of people's civil liberties, as am I. This is a limited program designed to prevent attacks on the United States of America. And I repeat, limited. And it's limited to calls from outside the United States, to calls within the United States, but they are of known numbers, of known Al-Qaeda members or affiliates. And I think most Americans understand the need to find out what the enemy's thinking. And that's what we're doing. We're at war with a bunch of cold-blooded killers who will kill on a moment's notice. And I have a responsibility, obviously, to act within the law, which I'm doing. It's on a program that's been reviewed constantly by Justice Department officials, a program to which the Congress has been briefed, and a program that is, in my judgment, necessary to win this war and to protect the American people.
That was President Bush speaking Sunday. Meanwhile, the Washington Post is reporting the NSA passed on records of intercepted email and phone calls to other government agencies, including the FBI, the Defense Intelligence Agency, the CIA, and the Department of Homeland Security. This news comes on the heels of several other reports that the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Force, military intelligence, and local police departments have all been engaged in monitoring peaceful groups, including Greenpeace, PETA, the People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals, Catholic Worker, anti-war groups, and even cyclists in New York City. During the 60s and 70s, the military used NSA intercepts to maintain files on U.S. peace activists. It was this domestic surveillance that led Congress to intervene and pass Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act of 1978 in order to prevent future such abuses. The statute permits domestic intelligence surveillance with the approval of a court order from the FISA court. In 1975, Senator Frank Church, a Democrat from Idaho, said, quote, "We have a particular obligation to examine the NSA in light of its tremendous potential for abuse. The interception of international communication signals sent through the air is the job of NSA, and thanks to modern technological developments, it does its job very well. The danger lies in the ability of the NSA to turn its awesome technology against domestic communications," Church said. Congress is now considering holding a new round of hearings on Bush's domestic spying program. A bipartisan group of senators have already issued their public support, including several top Republicans, including Senator Dick Lugar of Indiana, Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and Arlen Specter of Pennsylvania. This is Democratic Senator Patrick Leahy of Vermont.
And this warrantless eavesdropping program is not authorized by the Patriot Act. It's not authorized by any act of Congress, and it's not overseen by any court. And according to the reports, it's being conducted under a secret presidential order based on secret legal opinions by the same Justice Department lawyers, the same ones who argued secretly that the president could order the use of torture. Mr. President, it is time to have some checks and balances in this country. We are a democracy. We are a democracy. Let's have checks and balances, not secret orders and secret courts and secret torture and on and on.
That was Vermont Senator Patrick Leahy. 2 weeks ago, a former NSA intelligence officer publicly announced he wants to testify before Congress. His name is Russell Tice. For the past two decades, he's worked in the intelligence field, both inside and outside of government, most recently with the National Security Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency. He was fired in May of 2005 after he spoke out as a whistleblower. In his letter, Tice wrote, quote, "It's with my oath as a U.S. intelligence officer weighing heavy on my mind that I wish to report to Congress acts I believe are unlawful and unconstitutional. The freedom of the American people cannot be protected when our constitutional liberties are ignored and our nation has decayed into a police state." Russell Tice joins us now in our Washington studio. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Good morning.
It's good to have you with us.
Well, thank you.
What made you decide to come forward? You work for the top secret agency of this government, one that is far larger and even more secret than the CIA.
Well, the main reason is, you know, I'm involved with some certain aspects of the intelligence community, which are very closely held. And I believe I've seen some things that are they're illegal. Ultimately, it's Congress's responsibility to conduct oversight in these things. I don't see it happening. Another reason is there was a certain roadblock that was sort of lifted that allowed me to do this, and I can't explain, but I will to Congress if allowed to.
Can you talk about the letter you've written to Congress, your request to testify?
Oh, it's just a simple request under the Intelligence Community Whistleblower Protection Act, which is a legal means to contact Congress and tell them that you believe that something is going wrong in the intelligence community.
Can you start off by talking overall, since most people until recently, until this latest story of President Bush engaging in these wiretaps of American citizens as well as foreign nationals in this country, perhaps hadn't even heard of the NSA. Can you just describe it for us? What is the National Security Agency? How does it monitor these communications?
Well, the National Security Agency is an agency that deals with monitoring communications for the defense of the country. The charter basically says that the NSA will deal with communications of overseas. We're not allowed to go after Americans, and I think ultimately that's what the big fuss is now. But as far as the details of how NSA does that, unfortunately, I'm not at liberty to say that. I'm going to walk out of here and end up in FBI interrogation room.
Russell Tice, you've worked for the National Security Agency. Can you talk about your response to the revelations that the Times, revealed in perhaps late, knowing the story well before the election, yet revealing it a few weeks ago, the revelation of the wiretapping of American citizens?
Well, as far as an intelligence officer, especially a SIGINT officer at NSA, we're taught from very early on in our careers that you just do not do this. This is probably the number one commandment of the SIGINT Ten Commandments as a SIGINT officer. You will not spy on Americans. It is drilled into our head over and over and over again in security briefings, at least twice a year, where you ultimately have to sign a paper that says you've gotten the briefing. Everyone at NSA who's a SIGINT officer knows that you do not do this. Ultimately, so do the leaders of NSA, and apparently the leaders of NSA have decided that they were just going to go against the tenets of something that's a gospel to a SIGINT officer.
We're talking to Russell Tice. We'll go to break and come back to him. He's former intelligence agent with the National Security Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency, worked at the NSA up until May of this past year, May of 2005. We'll be back with him in a minute. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. We're broadcasting on over 400 radio and TV stations around the country, on Pacifica, NPR, low-power FM community and college stations, as well as public access TV, PBS stations, and both TV satellite networks, Dish Network Channel 9415 Free Speech TV, 9410 Link TV, as well as on DirecTV Channel 375, and we're video and audio podcasting at democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. As we talk to Russell Tice, former intelligence agency with the National Security Agency, formerly with the Defense Intelligence Agency, worked with the NSA up until May 2005. Russell Tice, what happened then? What happened in May of 2005?
Well, basically, I was given my walking papers and told that I was no longer a federal employee. So,
why?
Some time ago, I had some concerns about a coworker at DIA who exhibited the classic signs of being involved in espionage. And I reported that and basically got blown off by the counterintelligence office at DIA and kind of pushed the issue because I continued to see a pattern of there being a problem. And once I got back to NSA, I pretty much dropped the issue. But there was a report that came across my desk in April of 2003 about two FBI agents that were possibly passing secret counterintelligence information to a Chinese double agent, Katrina Leung. And I sent a secure message back to the DIA counterintelligence officer, and I said, I think the FBI is incompetent. And the retaliation came down on me like a ton of bricks.
What would you say to those who say you're speaking out now simply because you are disgruntled?
Well, I guess that's a valid argument. I was fired, but I've kind of held my tongue for a long time now, and I've known these things have been going on for a while. The classification level of the stuff I deal with, it basically what we call black world programs and operations, are very, very, very closely held. And whether you think this is retaliation or not, I have something important to tell Congress, and I think they need to hear it. I'd like to think my motives aren't retaliation, but, after what I've been through, I can understand someone's argument to think I've been jaded.
What about the risks you take as a whistleblower? I wanted to play a clip of FBI whistleblower Sybil Edmonds. She was working for the FBI after 9/11 as a translator, translating intercepts. And ultimately, she lost her job. And I asked her if she was afraid of speaking out.
There are times that I am afraid. But then again, I have to remind myself that this is my civic duty and this is for the country, because what they are doing by pushing this stuff under this blanket of secrecy, what they are hiding is against the public's welfare and interest. And reminding that to myself just helps me to a certain degree overcome that fear.
That was Sybil Edmonds. Russell Tice, you are a member of her group, the National Security Whistleblowers Coalition.
That I am. National Security Whistleblower Coalition is basically put together of people who are in sort of the same boat that I'm in, that have brought whistleblower concerns to the public or to their prospective chain of supervisors, and have been retaliated against. In the intelligence community, all the whistleblower protection laws are pretty much exempt the intelligence community. So the intelligence community can put forth their lip service about, oh, yeah, we want you to report waste, fraud, and abuse, or you shall report suspicions of espionage. But when they retaliate you for doing so, you pretty much have no recourse. I think a lot of people don't realize that. And Sybil has basically started this organization to bring these sort of concerns out into the public, and ultimately to get Congress to start passing some laws to protect folks that are going to be in a position to let the public let Congress know that crimes are being committed. And that's what we're talking about. We're talking about a crime here. So, you know, all this running around and looking for someone who dropped a dime on a crime is a whole lot different than something like the Valerie Plame case.
What do you think of the Justice Department launching an investigation into the leak, who leaked the fact that President Bush was spying on American citizens?
Well, I think this is an attempt to make sure that no intelligence officer ever considers doing this. What was done to me was basically an attempt to tell other intelligence officers, hey, if you do something like this, if you you do something to tick us off, we're going to take your job from you. We're going to do some unpleasant things to you. So right now, the atmosphere at NSA and DIA, for that matter, is fear. The security services basically rule over the employees with fear. And people are afraid to come forward. People know if they come forward, even in the legal means, like coming to Congress with a concern, your career is over. And that's just the best scenario. There's also sorts of other unfortunate things, like perhaps if someone gets thrown in jail for either a witch hunt, something trumping up charges, or this guy who's basically reporting a crime.
And what do you think of the news that the National Security Agency spying on American citizens without a court order and foreign nationals is now sharing this information with other agencies the other agency you worked for, the Defense Intelligence Agency?
Intelligence officers work with one another all the time. As an analyst, you might have a problem. Everybody gets together. It's just common sense to find out what everybody knows. Come to a consensus as to what the answer is. It's sort of like a puzzle. You chunks of the puzzle, and maybe you have a few chunks as a SIGINT officer, and the CIA has a few chunks in their arena, and DIA has a few elements of it, and everybody gets together and does a little mind meld to try to figure out what's going on. So it's not unusual for the intelligence community to share information. But when we're talking about information on the American public, which is a violation of the FISA law, then I think it's even something more to be concerned about.
Were you ever asked to engage in this?
No. And if I did so, I did so unwittingly, which I have a feeling would be the case for many of the people involved in this. More than likely, this was very closely held at the upper echelons at NSA, and mainly because these people knew. General Hayden, Bill Black, and probably the new one, Keith Alexander, they all knew this was illegal. They kept it from the populace of NSA, because every NSA officer certainly knows this is illegal.
What do you mean if you did so, you did so unwittingly?
Well, there are certain elements of the aspects of what is done where, you know, there are functionaries or technicians or analysts that are given information and you just process that information. You don't necessarily know the nitty-gritty as to, you know, where the information came from or the it's called compartmentalization. It's ironic, but, you know, you could be working on programs and the very person sitting next to you is not cleared for the programs you're working on, and they're working their own programs, and each person knows to keep their nose out of the other person's business because everything's compartmentalized, and you're only allowed to work on what you have a need to know to work on.
What about the telecoms, the telecommunications corporations working with the Bush administration to open up a back door to eavesdropping, to wiretapping?
Well, if that was done, and you know, and I use a big if here, and remember, I can't tell you, you know, what I know of how NSA does its business, but I can use you know, the wiggle words like if and scenarios that that don't incorporate, you know, specifics. But nonetheless, if U.S. gateways and junction points in the United States were used to siphon off information, I would think that the corporate executives of these companies need to be held accountable as well, because they would certainly also know that what they're doing is wrong and illegal. And if they have some sort of court order or some sort of paper or something signed from some government official, Congress needs to look at those papers and say, you know, look at the bottom line and see whose signature's there. And, you know, these corporations know that this is illegal as well. So, you know, everyone needs to be held accountable in this mess.
When you come on board at these intelligence agencies, at the National Security Agency, what are you told? I mean, were you aware of the Church hearings in the 1970s that went into the illegal spying on, monitoring of, surveilling of, wiretapping of American citizens?
Well, that's something that's really not drummed in your head. That's more of a history lesson, I think. And the reasoning ultimately for the FISA laws and for what's called USID 18, which is sort of the SIGINTER's Bible of how they conduct their business. But the law itself is drilled into your head, as well as the tenets of USID 18, of which the number one commandment is thou shalt not spy on Americans.
We're talking to Russell Tice, former intelligence agent with the National Security Agency, worked at the NSA up until May of 2005. What is data mining?
Data mining is a means by which you have information and you go searching for all associated elements of that information in whatever sort of data banks or data databases that you've put together with information. So if you have a phone number and you want to associate it with, say, a terrorist or something, and you want to associate it with, you know, who's this terrorist talking to, you start doing a data on, you know, what sort of information or what sort of numbers does that person call, what are the frequency of time, that sort of thing, and you start basically putting together a bubble chart of, you know, where everybody is. You know, Lord help you if you got a, you know, a wrong phone call from one of these guys, a terrorist overseas or something, and you're American. You're liable to have the FBI camping out your doorstep, apparently, from everything that's going on. But it's basically a way of searching all the data that exists, and that's things like, you know, your credit card records and you know, driver's license things, anything that you can get your hands on, and try to associate it with some activity. I think if we were doing that overseas with known information, it would be a good thing if we're pinning them down. But ultimately, when we're using that on, if we're using that with U.S. databases, then ultimately, once again, you know, the American people their civil rights are being violated.
Do you expect you're being monitored, surveilled, wiretapped right now?
Yes, I do. As a matter of fact, in you know, sometimes you just don't know. And being, you know, what they've basically accused me of, I, you know, I can't just walk around thinking that, you know, everybody's, you know, licking my heels, you know, following me around. But in one scenario, I turned the tables on someone I thought was following me, and he ducked into a convenience store, and I just walked down there, and I saw him out of my peripheral vision, And I basically walked down to where he ducked into it. And in the store, I walked up behind him. He was buying a cup of coffee. And he had a Glock on his hip and his FBI badge. So I don't think it takes a rocket scientist to figure out what was going on there.
The National Security Agency, or I should say the United Nations Security Council, there was a scandal a year or two ago about the monitoring of the diplomats there. It was in the lead up to the invasion, the U.S. wanting to know and put pressure on these Security Council ambassadors to know what they were saying before any kind of vote. What is the difference between that kind of monitoring and the monitoring of American citizens?
Well, if the monitoring was done against foreigners and the monitoring was done overseas, as far as I know, that's perfectly legal. It's just a matter of, you know, who you're monitoring and where you're doing the monitoring. If it's done at home and they're Americans, then you have a different scenario. And we're all trained that, hands off. If you inadvertently run across something like that in the conduct of what you're doing, you immediately let someone know if it's involved in something being recorded. It's immediately erased. It's something that we all know. You just don't do. You know, overseas okay, here at home not so okay.
I wanted to play for you the clip that we ran of President Bush earlier and get your response. This is President Bush on Sunday.
Ed, I can say that if somebody from Al Qaeda is calling you, we'd like to know why. In the meantime, this program is conscious of people's civil liberties, as am I. This is a limited program designed to prevent attacks on the United States of America. And I repeat, limited. And it's limited to calls from outside the United States, to calls within the United States, but they are of known numbers, of known Al-Qaeda members or affiliates. I think most Americans understand the need to find out what the enemy's thinking. And that's what we're doing. We're at a war with a bunch of cold-blooded killers who will kill on a moment's notice. I have a responsibility, obviously, to act within the law, which I'm doing. It's on a program that's been reviewed constantly by Justice Department officials, a program to which the Congress has been briefed, and a program that is, in my judgment, necessary to win this war and to protect the American people.
President Bush, Russell Tice, you're with the National Security Agency, or you were until May 2005. If Al-Qaeda is calling, the U.S. government wants to know your response.
Well, that's probably a good thing to know. But that's why we have a FISA court and FISA laws. The FISA court, it's not very difficult to get something through a FISA court. I kind of liken the FISA court to a monkey with a rubber stamp. The monkey sees a name. The monkey sees a word justification with a block of information. Can't read the block, but just stamps affirmed on the block. And the banana chip rolls out, and then the next paper rolls in front of the monkey. When you have like 20,000 requests and only, I think, four were turned down, you can't look at the FISA court as anything different. So you have to ask yourself the question, why? Why would someone want to go around the FISA court in something like this? I would think the answer could be that this thing is a lot bigger than even the president has been told it is, and that ultimately a vacuum cleaner approach may have been used, in which case you don't get names, and that's ultimately why you wouldn't go to the FISA court. And I think that's something Congress needs to address. They need to find out exactly how this system was operated and ultimately determine whether this was indeed a very focused effort or whether this was a vacuum cleaner type scenario.
Did you support the president, Russell Tice? Did you vote for President Bush?
I'm a Republican. I voted for President Bush, both the last election and the first election where he was up for president. I've contributed to his campaign. I get a Christmas card from the White House every year, I guess because of my nominal contributions. But it's not like, and I think you're going to find a lot of folks that are in the Department of Defense and the intelligence community, you're apt to be on the conservative side of the fence. But nonetheless, we're all taught that you don't do something like this. And I'm certainly hoping that the president has been misled in what's going on here, and that the true crux of this problem is in the leadership of the intelligence community.
You're saying in the leadership of your own agency, the National Security Agency?
That's correct. Yeah, because certainly General Alexander and General Hayden and Bill Black knew that, that this was illegal.
But they clearly had to have authorization from above. And Bush is not contending that he did not know.
Well, that's true, but the question has to be asked, what did the president know? You know, what was the president told about this? You know, it's just, there's just too many variables out there that, that we don't know yet. And ultimately, I think Congress needs to find out those answers. If the president was fed a bill of goods in this matter, then that's something that has to be addressed. Or if the president himself knew every aspect of what's going on, if this was some sort of vacuum cleaner deal, then it is ultimately, I would think, the president himself that needs to be held responsible for what's going on here.
And what do you think should happen to him?
Well, you know, that's certainly not up to me. But, you know, I've heard all the talk about impeachment and that sort of thing. You know, I saw our last president, you know, get impeached for what personally I thought, you know, should have been something between his wife and his family and the big guy upstairs. It's not up to me, but if the president knew, if this was a vacuum cleaner job, and the president knew exactly what was going on, and ultimately what we're hearing now is nothing but a cover-up and a whitewash, and we find that to be the case, then I think it should cause some dire consequences for even the president of the United States if he indeed did know exactly what was going on, and if it was a very large-scale, you know, suck-up-everything kind of operation.
This investigation that the Justice Department has launched, it's interesting that Alberto Gonzalez is now Attorney General of the United States. The latest story of the New York Times, Gonzalez, when he was White House counsel and Andrew Card, Chief of Staff, went to Ashcroft at his hospital bedside to get authorization for this. Can he be a disinterested party in investigating this now as Attorney General himself?
Well, yeah, I think that... For anyone to say that the Attorney General is going to be totally unbiased about something like this, I think that's silly. Of course the answer is no. You know, he can't be unbiased in this. I think what a special for a prosecutor or something like that may have to be involved in something like this. Otherwise, we're just liable to have a whitewash.
What do you think of the term police state?
Well, you know, any time where you have a situation where U.S. citizens are being arrested and thrown in jail, and, you know, with a key being thrown away, you know, potentially being sent overseas to be tortured, U.S. citizens being spied on, you know, and it doesn't even go to the court that's, you know, that deals with these secret things. You know, I mean, think about it. You could have potentially, you know, somebody getting the wrong phone call from a terrorist and having them spirited away to some, you know, back alley country to get the rubber hose treatment and who knows what else. I think that would kind of qualify as a police state in my judgment. I'd certainly hope that Congress or somebody sort of does something about this, because you know, for Americans just to say, oh well, you know, we have to do this because, you know, because of terrorism, you know, it's the same argument that we used with communism years ago. You know, take away your civil liberties, but you know, use you know, some threat that's you know, that's been out there for a long time. Terrorism has been there for, you know, certainly before 9/11 we had terrorism problems, and I have a feeling it's going to be around for quite some time after whatever we deem as a victory and what we're doing now in the Middle East. But you know, it's just something that has to be addressed. We just can't continue to see our civil liberties degraded. Ultimately, it was Ben Franklin, I think, that said, you know, essentially, you know, those who would give up their essential liberties for a little freedom deserve neither liberty or freedom. And I tend to agree with Ben Franklin.
And your colleagues at the NSA right now, their feelings, National Security Agency?
Boy, I think most folks at NSA right now are just running scared. They have the security office hanging over their head, which has always been, a bunch of vicious folks. And now they've got this potential, witch hunt going on with the Attorney General. People in the intelligence community are afraid. They know that you can't come forward. You have no protections as a whistleblower. These things need to be addressed.
What do you mean you have no protection?
Well, like I said before, if as a whistleblower, you're not protected by the whistleblower laws that are out there. The intelligence community is exempt from the whistleblower protection laws.
So why are you doing it?
Well, ultimately, I don't have to be afraid of losing my job because I've already lost my job. So that's one reason. The other reason is because I made an oath when I became an intelligence officer that I would protect the United States Constitution, not a president, not some classification, for whatever, that ultimately I'm responsible to protect the Constitution of the United States. And I think that's the same oath the president takes for the most part. So, something like, you imagine if we were taking Americans and assassinating them for suspicions of terrorism. And then we just put some classification on it and said, well, this is super top secret, so, no one can say anything about that. Well, at what point do you draw the line and say enough is enough? We have to say something here.
What was your classification? How high up was your clearance?
Well, clearances go up to the top secret level, but once you get to the top secret level, there are many caveats and many programs and things that can happen beyond that point. I specialized in what's known as black world operations and programs. They're very closely held things that happen in operations and programs in the intelligence community that are closely held. And for the most part, these programs are very beneficial to ultimately getting information and protecting the American people. But in some cases, I think classification levels at these special, we call them special access programs, SAPs, could be used to mask basically criminal wrongdoing. So I think that's something ultimately Congress needs to address as well, because from what I can see, there's not a whole lot of oversight when it comes to some of these deep black programs.
Russell Tice, did you know anyone within the NSA who refused to spy on Americans, who refused to follow orders?
No, I did not. As far as, of course, I'm not witting of anyone that was told they will spy on an American. So, ultimately, when this was going on, I have a feeling it was closely held at some of the upper echelon levels. And you got to understand, I was a worker bee. I was the guy that wrote the reports and did the analysis work, and the detail guy. At some point, your reports have to get sent up the line, and then the management takes action at some point or another. But at my level, no, I was not involved in this.
Has Congress responded to your letter offering to testify as a former employee of the National Security Agency?
Not yet. Of course, the holidays, we've just had the holidays here, so everybody's out of town. So, I can't condemn Congress too much yet, because I faxed it out on, I do believe, the 18th of December, and, we're just getting into the new year. So,
and who did you send it to?
I sent it to the chairs of the Senate Intelligence Committee and the House Intelligence Committee, the CISI and the HPSI.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Is there anything else that you would like to add?
Well, I can't think of a whole lot, except ultimately I think the American people need to be concerned about allegations that the intelligence community is spying on Americans. One of my fears is that that this would cause going into the NSA and just tearing the place up and making what the good work that's being done at the NSA ineffective, because the NSA is very important to this country's security. And I certainly hope that some bad apples, even if these bad apples were at the top of NSA, don't ultimately destroy the capabilities of NSA and NSA's ability to do a good job at protecting the American people.
Russell Tice, former intelligence agent with the National Security Agency and the Defense Intelligence Agency, worked for the NSA up until May of last year. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. When we come back, John Perkins, Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Stay with us. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. That's Roy Campbell, and I'm Amy Goodman. As we turn now to John Perkins, returning to our airwaves, author of Confessions of an Economic Hitman. Years ago, he wrote the words, "Economic hitmen, EHMs, are highly paid professionals who cheat countries around the globe out of trillions of dollars. They funnel money from the World Bank, the U.S. Agency for International Development, and other foreign so-called aid organizations into the coffers of huge corporations and the pockets of a few wealthy families who control the planet's natural resources. Their tools include fraudulent financial reports, rigged elections, payoffs, extortion, sex, and murder. They play a game as old as empire, but one that's taken on new and terrifying dimensions during this time of globalization. I should know," John Perkins writes, "I was an EHM, an economic hitman." Welcome to Democracy Now!
Thank you, Amy. It's great to be here again.
Well, since we have last talked, many things have taken place, from the World Trade Organization meetings in Hong Kong to Evo Morales being elected in Bolivia to the New York City transit strike. Can you talk about the connections you see?
I think we're seeing a real change in consciousness, which is something we called for here last year about the same time, and one of the reasons I wrote the book, because people need to be aware. Where you live in a democracy, and people need to be aware of what's going on, and I think increasingly people are becoming aware of that. Yes, Bolivia voted for Evo Morales, who ran on a very strong anti-corporation, anti-U.S. Platform, and now Evo Morales becomes one of seven presidents in South America, representing over 80% of the population of South America, who have voted, presidents who have gone into office because they opposed American policy. We see in the New York transit strike laborers standing up to the corporatocracy saying, we deserve to have pension funds, we deserve to have health care, we deserve to have benefits. And yes, at the World Trade Organization in Hong Kong, we basically saw the corporatocracy beaten. In the end, they put together a statement that made it sound like things were all hunky-dory, but in fact, the developing countries really won in that one. Of course, that started in 1999 in Seattle, and then again in 2003 in Cancun with the World Trade Organizations there. So I think in the last year, we've seen a tremendous rise in consciousness among people that we want to move into new directions, becoming more democratic, make our leaders respond in democratic ways.
When you talk about yourself as an economic hitman, explain. Very briefly, though we have spoken before, for people who didn't hear that conversation, Talk about your work as a consultant.
Well, as we economic hitmen basically in the last four decades have managed to create the world's first truly global empire. And I talk in detail in the book, Confessions of an Economic Hitman, about this and in various countries where we went in to create this first truly global empire. We've done it primarily without the military. The military comes in only as a last resort. We've done it through economics, and we've done it very, very subtly. So it's been a secret empire, unlike all of history's previous empires. Most Americans don't realize that we've created this empire. They don't realize what we've done in Latin America. And the way economic hitmen work, we use many different techniques, but probably the most typical is that we'll identify a company that has resources our corporations covet, like oil. We'll arrange a huge loan from an organization like the World Bank for that country, but the money won't go to that country at all. It goes to big U.S. corporations, Bechtel, Halliburton, ones we all hear about all the time, to build infrastructure projects in that country. These projects, like industrial parks and power plants, benefit the very rich of those countries and do nothing for the poor except to leave the country in a huge debt, one it can't possibly repay, which means it can't give social services, education, health to its poor, and is put in a position where it doesn't repay its debts. So at some point, we economic hitmen go back in and we say, look, you can't repay your debts, so give us a pound of flesh. Sell oil to our oil companies real cheap, or vote with us at the next UN vote, or send troops in support of ours someplace in the world. And that's how we've created this empire. And we've done it without most Americans even realizing that it's happening.
And explain who you were working for.
Well, I was recruited by the National Security Agency, the agency that's getting so much attention right now because of spying on Americans, while I was still in college at Boston University. And the National Security Agency put me through a series of very extensive tests, including lie detector tests, personality tests. And I was in business school. They determined that I could be a good economic hitman. They also discovered a lot of weaknesses in my character. I like to think of them as kind of the three big drugs of our culture, money, power, and sex, that they could use as a hook to bring me in. So I was told from the very beginning by this amazing woman, Claudine, who's described in detail in the book, who was basically my trainer, that, look, you're going into a dirty business. Once you're in, you can never get out of this business, but we're going to make it very attractive for you to go into this business.
Now, you didn't join the NSA.
No, I never worked directly for the NSA. I worked for a company called Charles T. Main, big consulting firm out of Boston. And these days, almost all of this work is done by private contractors. It's not done directly by the CIA or the NSA. They may recruit us, but we work for private industry. The same is true of the jackals, Amy. If economic hitmen fail, which we don't usually do, but I did in Panama, for example, and I tell in detail in the book about how that ended up. My failure ended up in a jackal going in and assassinating Omar Torrijos, the president of Panama. When economic hitmen fail, the jackals go in and either overthrow governments or assassinate leaders. And they, too, do not work directly for the government. These days, they're private contractors. The days of the government agent, the old 007, who's licensed to kill, are long gone.
When you say you failed, you mean what?
Well, I was sent in to Panama to bring Omar Torrijos around, to bring him into our system. And he refused to do that. He said, look, I know if I play your game, he told me directly, if I play your game, I'll become very rich. But that's not what interests me. I want to help my poor people. And so he said, you can either get out of Panama or play the game my way. Well, we decided to stay and try to bring him around. He never would come around. And I knew all along that if I failed to bring this man around, something dire would happen to him. And, you know, this is what's going on in Latin America right now. Evo Morales is being visited this week by an economic hitman who's going into his office and saying, well, congratulations, Mr. President.
Who? Who is he being visited by?
Well, an economic hitman who has to remain nameless at this point. But
well, going we're going to leave it there for right now. But this is just part one of our conversation as we come to the end of our hour. We're talking to John Perkins. Confessions of an Economic Hitman is his book from a man who's done it, who's been there, who calls himself an economic hitman. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Berkshire, Hodo Kadus, John Hamilton, Anna Nagara, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich, and Maddie Harper, Aaron Mate, and Nell Geiser. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.